funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There is still more than a year and a half to go in the second Obama presidential term, but with a crop of would-be successors jockeying for attention with their own platforms and promises, 6 years in seems an appropriate time to ask whether our current president has lived up to his own ambitions for the country. Of course, his partisan adversaries have found fault all along, but as my guest this hour will argue, many of the greatest disappointments for Obama's supporters, from the failure to close Guantanamo to the bad actors in the financial meltdown emerging virtually unscathed from the crisis, stem from the fact that the president has often taken the path of least resistance in leadership. David Bromwich is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University. His essay, What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy, appears in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. David, welcome to Think.
Good to be here.
You voted for Barack Obama not once, but twice. What drew you to him and his message in 2008, and what brought you back again in 2012?
I thought he was a better candidate for president than John McCain, with Sarah Palin running as the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans in 2008. And I thought he was a better candidate than Mitt Romney in 2012. But I have to say, earlier in the first of those two elections, Obama seemed to me promising in ways that seemed to have struck a lot of other people, too. He was rational, calm, spoke in a collected way as if he had thoughts behind the thoughts, and wanted the best of the reasoning powers and the sympathies of the audience he seemed to imagine as he was speaking. So I wasn't one of the sort of rock crowd, mosh pit supporters of Obama, but I did work for him a little, contribute some money, and thought that his election brought some hope of turning around the country from the terrible crooked path it had gone into under Cheney and Bush.
You write that for President Obama, words and actions float free of each other. Is that a delicate way of saying he lies?
No, yes, he lies or tells half-truths or dissimulates or conceals, but I don't think he does that more than the average politician. He may do it a little less on the whole than our last two presidents. No, it means that Obama, as I have read him and watched him and thought about him, seems to me to have an extraordinary faith almost in the power of words, and particularly the power of his words, as if the function he was put into the presidency to perform were to speak the right words, and words about acts he means to execute. But if the actions don't quite come off, that's all right. The words are there, and we can cherish them, and something will come of them perhaps in the future. It's it's a non-political understanding of the value of words, because for a politician, words and actions have to be very carefully matched with each other.
Well, one pledge he made in very concrete terms during the 2008 campaign was to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. He was adamantly opposed to that prison complex there. Once he was elected, he did order the closure of Guantanamo. Why is it still open today?
His own statement about it quite recently, and I cite this in the article in Harper's this month, talking to a crowd in March of this year, Obama said that he had hoped we could close it, that we could get a consensus around closing it. I'm paraphrasing, not exactly quoting him now. But circumstances intervened. The politics of it turned hard, he said. And so the path of least resistance, those are his exact words, the path of least resistance seemed to be to put it off till another time, not to close it now, even though, he added, it's a stain on the honor of the country and it only helps to recruit jihadists. Now, what surprised me, and I think would surprise a lot of other people looking at the quotation in detail, is Obama speaking of his mode of operation in spring 2009, right after he became president, as taking the path of least resistance. It could have been anticipated that closing Guantanamo, though eminently possible, I believe, because remember, this was not long after John McCain had led the fight against torture for banning torture officially from the Army manuals and from U.S. tactics and saying we did not do this. McCain led that fight against Dick Cheney, was only brought much later to recognize there should be an exception for the CIA, but mainly for prosecuting the CIA. So McCain was halfway there already, and the mood of the country was very much opposed to or shocked by, I think, the abuses that had been revealed at Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib and Bagram and elsewhere. So coming into that, Obama had a lot of force going with him, but it could have been anticipated that it was going to be a difficult task. There are, strong proponents of militarism across the board in this Congress, and they're going to be for many years to come, thanks to the war on terror. But he seemed to have no plan, politically speaking, for how to close it. He put in charge of that business of his administration a lawyer who had previously worked for the Clintons, Greg Craig, who had defended Bill Clinton in the impeachment. Craig was given a great deal of latitude to figure out ways of doing it. But as the politics of it, Obama put it that way, as the politics of it got difficult, Craig became someone of less and less interest in the White House, and finally he was sacked. Now, the immediate cause for concern about closing Guantanamo came from Representative Frank Wolf, as early as May 2009, protesting against the release of the Uyghur inmates who had never been guilty of anything, some of the many Guantanamo prisoners who were taken by mistake. But Wolf was allowed to have tremendous power by simply standing in the way of Obama. There was no battle of words or of claims and counterclaims fought on this. Obama was silent. And gradually, forces rallied against the closing of Guantanamo until it was put into legislation.
You note here, as many observers have, that the president seems to avoid the business of politics to the detriment of his own agenda. And it's not simply that he's failed to cultivate support among Republicans. He's also not worked to great effect with lawmakers within his own party.
Yes. And let's not, at least I would choose not to hold him responsible for the intransigence of this Republican Party, starting almost as soon as Obama was elected. They resolved to oppose him on almost everything, just as they had opposed Clinton early on in his plan for health care. They thought that got them the midterm election of 1994 against Clinton, and they thought they could conquer Obama in much the same way. But they were, if anything, even worse in their desire to negate and nullify every measure Obama put forward. So the Republicans were a lost cause, but Obama continued to think that by trying to cultivate them, by calling in people like Susan Collins and other moderates, he could get a vote for his stimulus package, possibly a vote for the Affordable Care Act. None of that panned out, but he was very patient still in trying to go after the symbolic Republicans so that he could fulfill his promise of bipartisanship. On the other hand, he showed, and still does show, I think, an amazing lack of interest in the suffrage and opinions of the Democratic Party. From early on, remember, when he was elected in 2008, going into 2009, he had majorities in both houses of Congress. So though the Republicans were a lost cause from Obama's point of view, the Democrats were not. But he had a paucity of contact and connection with the Democrats that many of them testify to. It's sort of in muted tones, but you can read it sometimes in the lines, often between the lines, in stories in the New York Times or the Washington Post about the dissatisfaction among Democrats with this, not only that this man doesn't fight, but he doesn't consult them on the terms of the fight he intends to engage in. He doesn't, in some way, he doesn't consider himself part of the order of politics in the United States. He considers himself rather as a peculiar sort of figure floating above politics in a slightly separate realm, an inspirational realm, an oratorical realm, and an executive realm, too, when you think about drone strikes and the Libya war, which were done without anyone's command except his own.
Reading your piece, I was thinking about the fact that the man who is now President Obama had some state legislative experience, not even a full term in the U.S. Senate. Do you think it's possible, had he spent more time as a lawmaker, that he would have learned better skills of communicating with the people that he really needed on his side to get anything done?
Well, you're up against one of the many puzzles there, or contradictions about the man. He seems very deliberate, slow-moving, patient, thoughtful. And yet the facts of his biography show that he was very impatient to rise to the top. One of the co-workers with him as an organizer in Chicago said that Obama was always talking about his path to power and significance and wanted to know how powerful people connected with each other. How do you do it? That was one of his goals in applying to law school. And in law school, he came close to people like Michael Froman, who's sort of a corporate business Democrat, the one who's now negotiating the Trans-Pacific Pact, and others of that kind. As to his experience as a senator and earlier as a state senator, I don't know. That kind of work seemed to bore him. He was never doing it as his main occupation, so to speak. Almost as soon as he got into the U.S. Senate, he began giving interviews, trying to find a larger, elevated stage from which to speak, and thinking about running for president as early as 2005. And Harry Reid spotted this. He liked Obama early and said, you know, try it. You're obviously not interested in the Senate, but you have some of the qualities, gifts, physical presence, voice, et cetera, that would go with being president. I can give you one anecdote about his state Senate deportment and what it may say about his political character. I wrote an earlier piece on President Obama published by Tom Dispatch, and I think Tom Engelhart called it What Became of the President Obama Wanted to Become. I got a lot of letters on that, some of them from people who had known him in earlier years and saying, you know, they wanted to confirm the intuitions that I was speaking for. One guy said that he'd been working with State Senator Obama on a gun control measure in Illinois, and Obama had agreed to be in the committee hearing room when they heard an expert witness testify for the necessity of stricter gun regulation, licensing, and so on. And yet when the day came, this woman, who was the expert witness, was berated, hauled over, beaten back and forth by Republicans on the committee, and it turned into a very bad day. But the guy had seen Obama walking past the open door of the committee room. This is State Senator Obama, quite young then, and just walking past, looking in and then walking past instead of coming to join them as he had promised to do. He confronted him a few days later and asked, you know, we were expecting you to be part of the team then, and we could have used you because it turned into rather a bad day. And Obama said, well, I just walked past and looked in, and I saw a lot of shouting and gesturing, and I thought I have better ways of spending my time.
We're speaking this hour with David Bromwich, who is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University and author of an essay in the June issue of Harper's Magazine called What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sterling Professor of English at Yale University, David Bromwich. He wrote an essay for the June issue of Harper's Magazine called What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, you just told us this story about then State Senator Obama being rather conflict averse when he was working in Illinois. There are some examples in the piece of the same sort of behavior as a community organizer in Chicago. I wonder if you think that in America today, it is still true that a candidate of color has less room to court controversy and still hope to be elected to either a statewide or a nationwide office.
Well, courting controversy is always taking the path of a little bit more
resistance, isn't it?
But it's hard for a person of any color, I think. Obama seemed to be such a person, nevertheless. And it may have surprised even him how far his averseness to conflict carried into the presidency. I don't know. I met that last anecdote just to indicate that it's a pretty pronounced pattern of his conduct and experience throughout his life. The form in which the observation you've just made is often put is a little different. People say, well, you can't expect him to really go up against the Republican Party because it's terrible for a black man to be seen to get angry. He's a black man, he can never be angry. My response to that is, how often do we ever see a president get angry simply to come across as a leader and one who is reasonably self-restrained? A person in that high office and dignified office has to show some sense of restraint as a sort of example to people at large. But I don't think there was any special burden on Obama to press against his own instincts and not be passionate, not be strong for certain causes. What he did right from the start as president, and he was really untested as a leader in any form. He hadn't been the head of anything except the Harvard Law Review, and he ran that in a bipartisan way, telling both the left liberal wing of legal studies and the conservatives that, you know, there's room for all of our articles. But you can't quite run a country, especially one as ideologically polarized as this country now is, on that principle. So his pattern early on, and I think it carried through all the way until the last year or so, has been to say, the Republicans may seem overwrought, they may seem unreasonable, they may seem to us radical and extreme, but their fever will break. That's a figure of speech he used a few times. The Republican fever will break. It will break after the midterm election. Now that they've seen they've gotten one House of Congress in 2010. It will break after the 2012 election. Now that they see I have a second mandate from the American people. Maybe it will break after 2014, now that they have both houses of Congress. But that's not the way somebody deeply versed in politics and interested in accomplishing political deeds by means of politics ought to be thinking. So I suppose the small version, the boiled down version of the point I'm making is Obama doesn't really treat politics politically, and the conflict averseness is part of that. He's more like an inspirational speaker, a motivational speaker. He's more like a therapist. He's more like a bureaucrat dispensing funds to worthy causes. And I think he's never so much himself as when, for example, he is comforting people who've just been stricken by disaster, whether it's a hurricane or a mass murder of one of the shootings we've had in recent years. There you see something quite real in Obama, but it's only one of the capacities of a leader that is exercised at moments like that. It doesn't have to do with political negotiation, deal-making, and backing a policy which may encounter difficulties because it's a policy that calls for reversal of previous policies, as with the war on terror, as with closing Guantanamo, and so on.
How did Obama's blindness to the potential of a political opening affect the course of action he ordered for the war in Afghanistan?
Well, there's an incident that I cite in this Harper's article. from early November 2009, when the then ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, sent cables to the State Department suggesting that no more troops be inserted into the country, that the U.S. was just equipped to hold those regions where we had already stabilized things and had some help from Afghan forces, but that that war in general should be reevaluated because the country was too split up. The Taliban had stolen a march on the Afghan government in many regions far outside the cities, and it wasn't a good investment any longer of U.S. blood and treasure. That was an extraordinarily important breakthrough, and it was covered as such in the New York Times and other leading news outlets. But there was no use made of those cables from Ambassador Eikenberry, no use made of them at all by Obama, even though he had within his team at the White House people like Joe Biden and I think perhaps the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Cartwright, and some others who were for scaling down the Afghan investment of troops. Now, there were important and weighty figures pushing for escalation. There was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mullen, and there was Hillary Clinton, and there was Robert Gates. But it was for Obama to make the ultimate decision, and he decided to escalate for 18 months and then start drawing back at that point. Quite an odd decision and oddly shaped, and people noticed that at the time too. Obama said, well, we're going to insert new troops, and then almost without regard to what we see about the performance of the war, we'll start withdrawing them at such and such a date. I mean, there was a case of, as it were, ultra-rational thinking that ignores real opportunities for the change of policy that you want, and a rather bureaucratized manner of execution.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the line to Harold in Fort Worth. Hi, Harold.
Yes, thank you. And Professor Abramowitz, I agree with what you're saying, but I had Eugene Wade for a freshman English course at Yale, so I feel entitled to ask you this question.
Yeah, well, he was a friend of mine, so I'm glad to hear from you.
Oh, what a marvelous teacher and man. Professor, I'm a Democrat, but I, from the beginning, was stumped by the great impact that Obama's oratorical skills had on people. He got the Nobel Prize early. He had 100 or 200,000 people hear him in Berlin. I'm a Democrat, but I'm curious as what do you think the Obama supporters felt that his great oratorical skills would qualify him to be a good president?
Well, I'm not a great admirer of the content of his speeches. And the speech that people seem to praise the most, at least the mainstream of American opinion makers and backers of the foreign policy that has continued from Bush through Obama, that is his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, which was a sort of heroic history of American foreign policy for the last 70 years, saying that we were the holders of the fort of the free world, and it was our sacrifices, it was to our sacrifices that Europe owed all the good that had come to this world in the last half century. I think the content of his speeches is actually often rather platitudinous, and to repeat that word, but not meaning it as heavy appreciation, inspirational. But he has a good voice. He has a great, good baritone voice. He has a good manner in looking into the camera. He admired Reagan, and I think he learned some things in an actor-like way from Reagan. And he was an extraordinarily handsome pretty evidently intelligent man running for president who would become our first black president. And I think, that combination and the dignity with which he held himself and his family and all the rest, I think that people found thrilling. And I found it thrilling, too. And I was moved the day of the inauguration, and I really had high hopes. But he received a Nobel Prize for the hopes he sowed rather than for any achievement he had yet been observed to make. And that Nobel Prize is still to be earned.
How did the president manage to speak out so vociferously against warrantless wiretapping during the 2008 campaign without ultimately, at least broadly, being held to account for the fact that he's done very little to interfere with unauthorized domestic surveillance?
Well, he not only spoke against mass warrantless surveillance, but he said that he would personally filibuster against any legislation that let the telecoms off the hook for having supplied the data mined materials of their customers to the government. That was an illegal plan, and there were motions underway to hold the big telecoms answerable. I think that filibuster would have been an extraordinary thing, but it would have been new to Obama's experience. He would have been standing alone. He would have been doing something quite remarkable and relatively isolated. And it was a theatrical declaration. I suppose he believed it at the time, but he's given to statements like that, rather exalted, somewhat inflated statements of things he'd like to do. He said things that were really sillier than that, that if you once think about them, he could have had no realistic intention of doing. For example, he said if workers ever went on strike in a large way that was worth sympathizing with, when he was president, he said, you might remember this, I'll put on a pair of comfortable shoes and march on the picket line with you. Now imagine that, a president of the United States getting into slacks and comfortable shoes, raising his picket sign and going on the picket line. No, he can't do that. You can't be the organizer president in that sense. The two roles just don't go together. But I think there is a large element of wishful, pleasant fantasy in how Obama considered the things he would do when he was president. And when he thought about them, he made the statement, and the statements all sounded nice. He really had his chance to put on those comfortable shoes and march on a picket line when the protest of teachers and other government workers being denied their pensions by Scott Walker sprang up in the state of Wisconsin. But Obama was in a neighboring state making speeches and could have just dropped by in his airplane and made an appearance and chose not to. Didn't even ever comment on the Wisconsin doings. So far from fulfilling the promise that he made on that or on making sure that there was no more warrantless surveillance, he simply became prudential, expedient, and decided he didn't want to be the one, I suppose, responsible for the next big attack on the U.S. if somebody could be held to blame and said, and it was said, oh, well, if only we'd done a lot more massive warrantless surveillance, this would never have happened. I think that's a great fear of Obama. And one of the real disasters of his presidency is it's going to be a fear that continues into the next administration, too, that the number one consideration by the president is going to be, let me not be blamable for another serious attack on the United States. And that means that the whole of our structure of civil liberties, the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendments in particular, are at risk. Because if you're worried constantly, and most of all, about not being blamed for an attack, you're not going to worry about living under a constitution of rights any longer.
All right, let's talk about what was the signature achievement, certainly of the first term, perhaps of the entire Obama presidency, and that is the passage of the Affordable Care Act. How did President Obama decide to take up health care as a major initiative in the first place?
Well, according to the reporting of Ryan Litza in The New Yorker, and this came up in a story on what happened to cap and trade, which was that enterprise, the hope of getting that sort of environmental legislation through, gradually became a matter of less and less interest to the White House in 2009, 2010, because what absorbed them was the idea of health care. But Obama had not come into his interest in health care very early. He was one of the lagging primary candidates in 2007 and 8 in putting forward a detailed proposal about health care, and Hillary Clinton was judged to be far ahead of him, as was John Edwards. Obama and his advisors tested with various audiences, perhaps with focus groups, certainly with congressional people, which would be the more popular first step to take if he wanted to, as a phrase he likes to use, do something big. Cap and trade, that is to say environmental legislation that would have an impact on global warming, or health care. And health care came up on top. It was the more popular. So he chose that, and this is, again, according to Litza, but it sounds to me very plausible. He chose that on the basis that it would be easier to accomplish. And it could have been accomplished faster, given his willingness to compromise with Big Pharma and the rest of the large interests involved. It could have been accomplished faster if it hadn't been so much a resolution of his that it should be bipartisan legislation. Remember, there was a lot of waiting around, not only for Max Baucus's committee and the other four committees assigned to do work on that law, but also because he wanted at least one Republican to sign on with him. None ever did.
Let's go to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I almost don't know where to begin. First of all, I would just point out that your guest didn't really answer the question you asked earlier about whether it's really possible for the first African-American president to actually accomplish. I think he's pretty naive if he doesn't understand all that's involved in that. And I would just encourage him to talk to any African-American who's been the first of anything major and see how constrained they are. But more important, even more deeply, I continue to be amazed at how particularly kind of what I view as the Northeastern elite punditocracy, mostly Anglo, I continue to be amazed at how critical and withering their criticism is of President Obama when they were not nearly so critical of President Clinton, even though, in my view, President Obama has been much more progressive in what he's actually gotten done than President Clinton did. They ignore not only things like the Affordable Care Act and the fact that he saved the whole economy from the Great Depression, but a whole bunch of other things like reestablishing the regulatory framework in the country that had been pretty much dismantled in the Reagan and Bush years and continued to be dismantled in the Clinton years.
Well, Eddie, I'm going to need to put you on hold there. You put a lot on the table, and I really appreciate your call. We will get a response from David after the break. We're speaking this hour with Yale University English professor David Bromwich about his essay in Harper's, What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Bromwich, who is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University and author of an essay in the June issue of Harper's called What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. As Eddie was just before the break, David, and was frustrated that perhaps you hadn't acknowledged the particular constraints on the president because he is a black president and the first black president, and also felt like I've not read anything that you wrote about the Clinton administration, but that there has been more criticism from what he referred to as the sort of Northeastern elite, intellectual elite, than there was of Bill Clinton.
Right. I've been interested in politics pretty much my whole conscious life and have written some of my scholarly work has to do with political writing and action in the 18th and 19th century. But I didn't write a great deal about contemporary politics before the early 2000s, when it seemed to me that the sudden turn away from the former constitutional identity of our country that had been taken by Bush and Cheney demanded that one say more and think out loud and try to put facts into evidence that were easy to find but that were not part of people's opinions. So I wrote less about politics then, but I was critical of the Clintons in what I did write, and I agree with the caller that Obama compares not unfavorably to Clinton, in many ways. I'd even say, on the whole, I think he's compromised less, given the obstacles, than Clinton did. But he's compromised in many of the same ways, and his administration is full of, his cabinet was full of Clinton advisors. His chief of staff was Rahm Emanuel, no close friend of Obama's, but brought in because he was such solid Clinton stuff. He made Hillary Clinton his Secretary of State, surprising me and a great many of his other supporters at the time. I also think Obama could have learned things from the Republican attack leading to the impeachment of Clinton, which he did not learn. It was strange of Barack Obama, if he had his eyes and ears open in the 1990s, to be saying in the primaries against Hillary Clinton that the 90s was all about partisan bickering, and he was going to get rid of all that partisan bickering by being a uniter. Bill Clinton was prosecuted by the Republicans and before that pestered and harried by them for reasons that didn't have to do just with something wrong with Bill Clinton's bickering on his side. They did not want any kind of liberal Democrat in power in the White House. And the animosity that came out so vengefully against Clinton has then been applied to Obama. I don't think he's been given a worse ride than Clinton. He's been given a very similar rough ride. Now, the other point made by the caller about how difficult it is to be the first African-American at anything, I take that point, and I take it that Obama must have looked that hard in the face before he ran for president. It took great physical courage for a black man to run for president, and it takes courage for him to stand up there and be president now. But I am not alone, and I'm not one of the Eastern Anglo people who are all alone in criticizing Obama. I get a lot of letters and comments from African-American friends and African-American writers whom I don't even know but have read. I'm not at liberty to divulge all their names, but I could also quote statements against Obama or highly critical of him or stands so opposed to his stands that they amount to criticism by representatives who are African-Americans, such as Keith Ellison and Donna Edwards and Barbara Lee. Or a black social critic like Cornel West. So I'd ask your listener to think about what those people may have in mind. Are they really getting it wrong that it was possible for an African-American president to take the path of more resistance at times? I don't think we should leave character out of it. Don't put this down just to collective identity, race identity, or even personality types. There are great idiosyncrasies and peculiarities in Obama, both as to the fantasies he seems to have cherished and to the role of conciliator, which is the deepest role he constantly wants to play.
We have an email here from John in Oak Cliff who says, "It seems we are always disappointed with our presidents at this stage in the game. What separates Obama from this basic phenomenon?"
Well, if you look at who Barack Obama seemed to be, the stands he had taken, the left liberal position he occupied in American politics, coming after Bush and Cheney, the difference seemed to be enormous. And I think the sense of letdown that started pretty early and has continued in the Obama administration comes from the fact that so many of the Bush-Cheney policies have been continued. That includes not only large elements of the war on terror. We're now at war with drones rather than boots on the ground, for the most part, in something like six countries in the greater Middle East, including North Africa. In 2010, Obama agreed, because he had lost the midterm election, to extend for another 13 months the tax cuts for the very rich. The mark of the new architecture that Dick Cheney put in to executive power in the United States and the whole look and feel of American policies, both at home and abroad, has changed much less than we had a reasonable right to expect, given the way Obama presented himself as a candidate. It has to do with circumstances. No person, no single person, even the president of the United States, is altogether to blame for such things. But I think his responsibility is real, and it's something we have a hard time talking about reasonably. the wild, very far-right Republicans who think Obama, you know, doesn't have the right birth certificate and that he's really a Muslim or that he's a Nazi or a fascist or something, put those people to one side. Those people have been around in American politics for a long time. They amount to 15-20% of the electorate at most. But sort of honest criticism from the center left, the position from which Obama ran, has been very scarce. And I think it's been very scarce in his administration, too, partly because he appoints to positions of power people whose power he has been the creator of. There have been no senior advisors on the Democratic side that Obama took very close to himself and has consulted with.
You suggest that it might be time to reframe the narrative shaping American perception of the potential threat from Iran, particularly with regard to this nuclear deal that the president has been advocating. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether you think he has the capacity to reshape that narrative?
I don't know if he'll have the resources, the energy, and the luck, the conjunction of events and decisions on his part to bring off the P+5 treaty with Iran that will lead to a gradual lightening of sanctions against that country and to insurance against Iran coming to possession of a nuclear weapon. I think he means to accomplish that. I think he would like it to be his one great achievement in foreign policy. To put up together with affordable care in domestic policy. And I think very plain things need to be said about these negotiations with Iran that have not yet been said by the president who wants the agreement to work out so much. It has to be said, for example, that in our present confrontation with ISIS and the trouble of mind Americans and our European allies and our allies in the Middle East all feel about the rise of this fanatical Islamist sect, it isn't said plainly, it isn't said often, as it must be by a president who wants to educate the public to accept a new and difficult position, as on Iran no longer being an enemy. It hasn't been said that those are Sunni Islamists and that Iran is governed by Shiites, that what we're seeing in the Middle East is a sectarian religious war, and religious wars are ferocious, but that the Shiites in general are far less dangerous to the United States and to Western interests and to religious fanaticism in general than the Sunni fanatics are. Therefore, you can't fight against Iran and fight against ISIS at the same time. You need Iran on your side in order to win that, or at least fight off to a stalemate, that danger. It's comparable to admitting that you needed Russia on your side in the Second World War in order to win against Hitler. Although I don't know of any charges against the Iranian regime that are horrific as the charges you could bring against Stalin's regime in the Second World War. Nevertheless, it was noticed by many people, you know, Churchill, Roosevelt among them. These are people we have to fight with in order to fight against a much greater danger. That message hasn't come across to the American people. Right now you have John McCain conducting hearings, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying things like Bashar Assad is the father of ISIS. An absurd statement. Assad is a non-religious figure. He's a secular authoritarian. And the religious figures who run Iran, the mullahs, are Shiites, to repeat. They are nothing to do with ISIS. But McCain and his nonsense will keep being absorbed into the pores of the American public as long as a president or someone you know, designated by him doesn't start telling the simple truth about this and repeating it often enough for people to absorb it. So I think that's a kind of education he has to inculcate on the American people, and he's nowhere near doing it. I hope he does. I hope he realizes that's important. He has to get the mainstream media on his side too, but he hasn't yet begun. And if the Iran agreement is going to succeed, given all the opposition to it from the people who want permanent war, I think that's a plan he's going to have to start being seen to execute.
A number of people have written me via email and Twitter, essentially asking that you talk about the things you think the president has done right.
I think affordable care is an enormous achievement. It isn't as simple and economical and desirable as single payer would have been, but I take it that single payer was impossible. I think that the executive imposed regulations on the coal industry and other measures of that sort that have come down from the president and that are being debated now in the courts, challenged in the courts, nevertheless, are, you know, late to come, but very valuable measures for support of the environment. I think his failure of interest on global warming in the middle years of his administration, roughly from 2010 to the beginning of 2013, is a great disappointment. That is lost time that we could ill afford to lose. But he's also spoken the truth about global warming in recent months, and he seems to be bent on trying to do serious things to fight against climate disruption. You know, Obama stands well, as any liberal Democrat would, in my view, compared to the Republican far right on many other issues, on, you know, help for financial and medical assistance for veterans, on assistance for people who want to go to college but can't afford it. So my list would be, I think, the usual list for a Democrat who comes to the presidency with social democratic expectations and enforces or brings into the public view proposals for some policies of that sort. But I don't think Obama has been as energetic or as single-minded about any of them as he was on affordable care. I also think his two Supreme Court appointments have been excellent. And I think if he makes a third, it will probably be good too. But some of what we're talking about there, I have to add, is the difference between the Democratic Party as it is now, which is a party of some privilege, and the Republican Party, which is simply the party of privilege.
Do you write a piece like this with the hope that it will have an impact on turning things around before the president leaves office in early 2017?
I don't write with a hope. I'm not the kind of whatever editorial or journalistic writer who hopes to have the ear of public persons when I'm writing. So it isn't in my mind that Obama or somebody around him might be a reader. I was raising a cheer for the Iran agreement and, as it were, you know, saying, here's what you got to do if you mean it about that. But, you know, get started educating the public. I do hope that that impact will be felt, whether from the piece I wrote or from what lots of other people end up writing in the form of advice. But I think the Iran agreement is his best hope for a mitigating impact against the worst of the war on terror, which we're still unfortunately immersed in.
David Bromwich is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University. His essay, What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy, appears in the June issue of Harper's. David, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for giving us the hour.
Thanks for letting me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.